Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler, February 21st, 2014. My gosh, the time is flying. Winter almost in our rearview mirror, unfortunately not quite yet. Hope you've all had a terrific week. Always great to get together with you at the end of the week. Catch a deep breath and try to sort out the madness that undoubtedly has charged at us at warp speed, and there's no shortage of crazy stuff to talk about this evening. I expect to be joined by a guest. In fact, he's here now. Horace Cooper will be visiting with us, but just for a short period of time. Let's bring him on, and then we will get to some other stuff. Horace Cooper, happy Friday.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good afternoon. What time zone are you operating under today? You got to stay out of that time machine, Horace. I'm telling you, you get stuck in the wrong time zone.
Well, I finally got up my status for flying to a point now where at least when I have to go to all across God's green earth, I'm at least able to upgrade and sit in the club for a little bit when I get a chance.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Put up your feet and act like a big shot, huh? So where besides hither and yon, where were you this time?
You tried that on the call before. My destination was not a resort, but a conference that shall go unnamed.
You sound like Dick Cheney in that unknown location.
Excellent.
I just couldn't resist. Why don't you tell my audience a little bit about yourself and the mischief that you've been up to? I mean, you know, you and I are both mischievous characters and of questionable repute on my case, not in your case.
Well, right now I am the co-chairman. I'm starting my second year as co-chairman of Project 21, and okay. I am also a fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research. Project 21, as many of your listeners may recall, is an organization made up of black Americans who believe in free markets, limited government, personal responsibility as the mechanisms whereby the problems facing both black America and America as a whole can get resolved.
Sounds like classical republicanism to me. Does that
well,
work?
Some people say that. I carry the banner of conservative.
Okay.
Now, I used to work on Capitol Hill. I worked for a congressman. His name was Dick Armey. He
right.
was the House Majority Leader. I served as his counsel for a time. I taught constitutional law at George Mason for a few years, and I actually worked in the Bush administration for a period. Since getting out of college and up through this point, I have intentionally tried as hard as I could to be the kind of person who adheres to his principles and tries to be the kind of person that understands and tries to make sure that the Constitution that our founders gave us is something that still has value for today and for future generations as well.
Boy, did you ever feel like a fish out of water, a man standing for his principles on Capitol Hill?
Well, before Ron Paul was nicknamed Dr. No, I actually worked for a congressman who was called Dr. No. We'd regularly be among the 22 or 23 votes no and 400 votes yes for various bad ideas that were deemed so popular that you had to go forward with it. And so it was always a little bit of a challenge and a thrill at the same time having that. But what I got to do in all of that time was see that he was a principled person, and that's how we should all try to be.
Yeah, a challenge and a thrill like falling out of an airplane with no parachute.
Yeah, I don't know how much of a thrill that would be. But it definitely would be a challenge.
You bet. I know that you're limited in time, which is why I curtailed my usually slightly more verbose introduction. So I know that you're probably hiding in some corner of the airport, having just landed back home. So why don't we get to the issue at hand, and you with your amazing background in constitutional law. The Obama administration once again attempted to foist something on the American people, this time what I perceive, and maybe you agree or disagree, and that's why it's always great having you on the show, and I got to tell you, I love when you come on the program, but this business about a monitor at broadcast stations, have I lost something here along the way?
Yeah, they've glammed up this idea of having the
well, there's a new term,
federal government.
Glammed up. I may have to use that. I like that.
Well, they call the whole project the implementation of what they call a critical information needs survey. And as part of this critical information needs survey, they plan, the FCC, Federal Communications, what is that?
Commission.
The FCC. Commission, thank you.
That's okay. That's what I'm here for. I'm thinking of me as your spotter and you're on the trampoline. Go ahead.
Now I'm worried.
You should be. You should be scared, very scared.
Well, the FCC wants to have monitors sit in the press rooms of all of the broadcast news programs in America that are over the airwaves. That's their limitation. So whereas MSNBC might not be covered by this, NBC would be covered by this. ABC would be covered by this. The Fox local news programs would be covered by this. Now, it's an it's a distinction without a difference, and the reason that I say that is actually NBC shares resources with MSNBC.
Right.
Fox Cable News shares resources with local Fox News. And the truth of the matter is a monitor isn't going to be able to ascertain what are the exempt activities that we should know about from the activities that we should know about. This isn't just troubling. This is seriously prejudicial to the ability of private, First Amendment-protected activity to go on unfettered because of the implicit threat that if you cover, quote, the wrong news, you'll have your license taken from you.
Well,
That's what happens in Venezuela. If you had a private news entity in North Korea, this could happen. It is presently happening in what's the former Soviet Union, now Russia. There are a lot of places where they have a pretense, Iran is an example, of a news industry, but the truth of the matter is the government all but sanctions whatever is going to be covered. That is the opposite of the model that we had adopted under our Constitution in the United States.
Wow. So I wonder if they would actually be able to work that little dump button. For those of you that are unfamiliar with it, there's an 8-second delay. I remember one day I was doing an interview in my car, and I used my hands free. I'm a good boy. But some guy banged into the back of my car, and I blurted out an expletive without even realizing it, and they dumped out of that broadcast as I got out of my car to see if any damage had been done. So the guy in the station, because of that delay, hit that button that cut me off before the public got to hear me use some choice language. Would they then be able to do the same thing? Let's say they're pushing for comprehensive immigration reform, a subject near and dear to my heart, and Mike Cutler comes on and says this is a wrong-headed move. They could then theoretically hit the dump button so the public wouldn't get to hear me say that. Do you think it would have gone that far if there hadn't been this big outcry? Because now apparently they've retreated a bit.
Right. They've now announced that this is something that needs to be studied more. Okay, so initial implementation is would have entailed monitoring, B, asking a series of questions about how stories are generated, C, assessing the stories to ascertain whether or not they are useful for the interests of the community, C, finally DAE.
Who's the arbiter, by the way?
Well, this is the point. This is the point. DAE gets to, we're either going to yank the license or come up with some interim measure where we would prevent those stories that we think weren't useful from spending so much broadcast time. So they wouldn't necessarily beep you. They would simply say to the broadcaster, you don't need to be interviewing Mr. Cutler. He doesn't have anything valuable to say. Our
survey
suggests that what people really want to know about is why we haven't moved quicker to a comprehensive immigration reform.
Wow.
That's the kind of thing, and the government should never have its hands on the scale. Look, there are some stations, and I'm not going to advertise their names here on this interview, but there are some stations that are actively promoting a bad idea of taking up the Senate bill and passing it as rapidly as possible and calling anyone who doesn't support that a bigot. Now, I support their right to do it. The good news is they're so biased and they're so unfair in their presentation, they have few viewers, so they're not really talking to a lot of people. But I don't want the government, and neither should anyone, want the government to come in and tell them they can't do it. But similarly, if a host or a program or a network decided they wanted to spend a full mission on opposing this comprehensive immigration effort that passed the Senate, that again is constitutionally protected activity. You asked the great question, who's going to be the arbiter? Under the First Amendment, listeners and viewers and readers are the arbiter. If
That's
they
right.
like it, if it's valuable, they continue. If they don't find it valuable, they don't find it appealing, they won't continue. I would no more support putting a gun up to someone's head to make them listen to information they want to than I would agree to have the government say that it could come up with a better mix of the kind of information. And let's remember this fact. We're not talking about there's only one radio station in your community. There are only two or three at most broadcast television stations in your community. Everyone, I just bought an HDT antenna in January just to see what was out there. There were 32 free channels that I was able to get, some of which call themselves cable channels that were being broadcast over the airwaves. You can't tell me that the problem is people don't have access and that the hogs are taking up all of the space and we want to make sure that they provide people with choice. There is choice. Government, when they come up with an idea like this, it only results in intimidation and not in actually helping consumers.
This is so disturbing. And you know, Megyn Kelly, the delightful Megyn Kelly, and I can't think of the guy's name, had a constitutional law professor on, who's a liberal. And he said, you know, I agree with many of what Obama wants, many of the things Obama wants to do. However, the obvious power grab where he's got a phone and a pen and doesn't care about law should scare the hell out of everybody. And that's the point.
Jonathan Turley, I'm going to be your spotter. That was Professor Jonathan Turley from Washington University. He has written in the Washington Post with his concerns about the president's idea that because of congressional inaction, it's incumbent upon him to, quote, go around that because he's got a pen and a phone. Now, I'm not clear on where the phone fit into the constitutional powers of the president. He does have a veto pen that he can either use to approve or deny. But under his orbit of discussion, it's I have this phone and I've got this pen, and it empowers me to take action. Here's the question that I have. Is there any way to look at our tripart federalist system, three federal entities and a system that involves 50 states that have experimental power? Is there any way to look at that and go, you know what the framers were looking for? They wanted it to be as simple as possible for change, for rules and laws to occur. They wanted it to occur like a hot knife through butter. Absolutely not.
Uh-huh.
What the founders believed, that there was liberty to be found in making it more difficult. You can have a popular idea. You still are going to have to operate within a framework that requires consensus. You're going to have to get buy-in from states. You're going to have to get, and their understanding of that was through the Senate. You're going to have to get buy-in from the popular community, the House of Representatives. You don't simply say, I take a poll, I like an idea. Now, a lot of his ideas are frankly bad in the polls, but even if they were, quote, popular in the polls,
right,
that's not the test. Our system is complicated. It is difficult and rigorous for a reason. Liberty is found in the inability of government to act too quickly.
By the way, wasn't it remarkable, for example, to go back to the Dream Act when he stood there in the Rose Garden on June, I think it was 15th or June 12th, whatever it was, a year and a half ago, and he said, Congress failed to act. Voting no is not a failure to act. It's acting deliberatively. They did not vote present like somebody we all know did in a legislative body on the state level, Chicago. Saying no is acting. You're not abdicating responsibility by voting no against bad legislation. You're acting appropriately. So when people say, well, you have to act, and, you know, Schumer said the same thing, a failure to act is not acceptable. Yes, it is, because if the action you want to take is worse than no action, take no action. You know, you're going the wrong way on a one-way street. I would rather you do nothing than stand on the gas pedal. I'd rather you step on the brake, but for God's sakes, don't jump on the gas pedal.
Absolutely.
Jumping on the gas pedal is acting, but...
That goes to the point about our system. Mere failure of the House to take up a bill or mere failure of the Senate to take up a bill is among the authorities that the founders intended Congress to have. Yes, that is a collective act in and of itself. We didn't take it up. We didn't hold a hearing on it. Or we could hold a hearing on it, or we could mark it up. We could bring it to the floor. All of those kinds of things are within the inherent authority of Congress. A so-called former constitutional law professor who stands up and says, when there are public policy needs that go unmet, I am going to obviate the need for any Congress or other authorities, and that includes state power, I am just simply going to do it on my own is someone who fails to appreciate what our founders intended and, in essence, threaten liberty. That's the most important principle. We could have 25 rights in the Bill of Rights. We could have 125 rights in the Bill of Rights. We would never figure out all of the areas of protection. Our founders recognized that concern, and they developed a system that made it harder to come up with new ideas that potentially threaten liberty or intrude on freedom. This is a signature protection of our system.
Built-in inertia, if you will.
Absolutely. And this president pretending that these problems that he faces are problems that no other president has ever faced is simply not true. There have been a number of presidencies. Jimmy Carter comes to mind. The last couple of years of Richard Nixon comes to mind that have had challenges. But people forget the first George Bush presidency. He had challenges. The senator from Connecticut, the senator from Maine, who was the Senate Majority Leader, a Democrat, made it his full-time mission to try to stymie the efforts of George Bush. Unlike Barack Obama, George Bush sat down with a liberal, Democratic-controlled House and Senate and came to agreement on some issues, many of which I personally don't like, but he understood that there had to be some give and take. So the landmark Clean Air Act got adopted, Clean Water Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, a hike in the minimum wage. A number of these measures passed with sizable support among Republicans and Democrats, because the president sat down and said, I recognize that you have some desires that are different from mine. Where can we find some common ground to meet? This president won't do that on entitlements. He won't do that on the tax code. He won't do it on immigration. He won't do it on almost any issue that comes forward. No reaching across the aisle and recognizing that there are political realities. Instead, he misrepresents, and his supporters misrepresent, the reality. You're not required to support the president's agenda, regardless of who he is. It's his job to figure out how to engage you in order to have some of his agenda to go forward. Bypassing Congress is not the answer.
You know, it's funny. I remember sitting on two criminal juries as a juror. Even though I was an agent, they felt I could be objective, and I was. In one case, I voted for a conviction. The other case, I voted for an acquittal based on the evidence presented at trial. But in both instances, after both sides had rested and the jury was given the case, the charging judges made a very interesting point, both of them, and it applies here as well. The judges told the jurors in charging them that whenever there is a trial, not only is the defendant on trial, but our system of justice is on trial. Wouldn't you say that the parallel is supposed to occur here in the legislative process as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I commend that judge for reminding people of this. It isn't simply the fact that someone was indicted that should be looked upon as evidence that they've done anything. That's right. The government's burden. That's why we have the standard that we have, that you're innocent until proven guilty. And our congressional, executive, judicial, and state power operational system is presumptively the case that doing actually nothing, taking no action, is presumptively preferred over any change, regardless of how amazing advocates of that particular change may be. And that concept is a very, very straight concept that is ingrained. It's endemic to our system.
It's called look before you leap.
Our framers understood this. They had
yes.
lived under a system where we didn't have those protections.
Well,
anyway, Mike, I'm going to have to run. I've enjoyed this. I like coming on your show, and I want to keep doing it.
I want to keep having you here. You're a fascinating character, and your wealth of knowledge and the experience and common sense and understanding of the law really enriches this program. And I want you to know how much I appreciate having you on the show, and I'd love to have you back very soon.
All right, thank you.
Hey, have a great weekend.
And
thanks for taking time out from Destinations Unknown en route to your home.
Always a pleasure.
Be well. That was really terrific. Really always great to have Horace join us. And now to get to a couple of points that I wanted to make before he jumped in with us, and he was en route. He was actually at the airport, and it's really terrific that he was willing to take time out coming home from an exhausting trip from locations not to be divulged, to en route home, that he would take time out at the airport to find the quiet place to join us on my program. I'm very honored. He has an amazing background, amazing perspective, somebody certainly worth listening to. I started out before Horace came on the line, explaining program is all about the First Amendment. I mean, I know that everyone says, well, Mike Cutler's going to talk about immigration. That is my area of expertise. You heard it again. I'm once again accused of being an expert on the subject. I guess I deserve that. But the point is, this is about much more than immigration. This program is about the First Amendment, about providing information for my listeners that you're not going to get anywhere else. And usually immigration is the focus of this program because that is my area of expertise and interest, but not always. Not always that I'm going to talk purely about immigration. But it's about having the freedom to have an honest conversation, sometimes disagreeing with the folks who come on, because in that disagreement, we celebrate the First Amendment. The First Amendment, everyone rattles off, well, First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, everybody knows that. and play a game over the weekend. Ask people you know, what are the elements of the First Amendment? And you know you're going to get those three, freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And they're very important tenets, very important. But there's two more, and most people forget it. Number one, the right to seek redress of grievances. Now, think about that. We certainly have tons of grievances. In this day and age, if you don't have grievances, you better go to the doctor and make sure you don't have a flatline EEG. We certainly have grievances, goodness gracious. But I will tell you that if you have a government monitor sitting in a control booth at a radio or television station, will you be able to air those grievances if they relate to the administration in power? That is a very frightening concept, that you might, if this administration had its way, stifle that kind of an exchange of facts, information, opinions. We are entitled to our opinions, and we are certainly entitled to air them. We need to be responsible. There is such a thing, though, as slander and libel and so forth. People need to know the difference between a fact and an accusation. We've got to be very careful and very respectful of each other. And that gets us to the next component of the First Amendment, that, of course, being the right for peaceable assemblage. It's right there. Now, what do they mean? They mean that a bunch of people can get together peaceably, you know, leave your guns, your clubs, your knives at home, and have the argument, have the conversation, have the discussion, have the debate. You know, back when I was in college, and I studied debate, back in high school when I was on the debating team, I've been doing this, I hate to admit it, but I've been engaged in debate for more than 50 years. So when you see those images of my ugly mug and you see all that gray hair, you know where it came from. But I've been doing debate for 50 years. And most of my coaches would not tell us which side of the argument we were going to be on until maybe 15 or 30 minutes before the actual debate. Because the idea is that you really do not understand your own position if you don't understand your opponent's position. I jokingly say that when there's a divorce, there's at least three sides to the argument, his, hers, and the objective truth. When you look at the contentious issues that we face today, and there is no shortage of contentious issues, it's simplistic to think that one side has all the answers, or one side is right and the other side is wrong. It is important for all Americans on each issue to be able to sit down over a cold beer, perhaps, or a hot cup of coffee, or whatever your pleasure is, and hash out the ideas, the facts, the way we just did with Horace. It is a delight to have him on the program, because what he provides isn't just an opinion, because opinions, frankly, are like backsides. Everyone's got one. But he's a learned man, a professor, an attorney, a constitutionalist. He truly understands the issues in ways that many people don't. So these discussions are very worthwhile. And while I may not agree with him on all of his political perspectives, I am a registered Democrat. We do have our areas of disagreement. But understand something. It doesn't make us adversaries or enemies. This is about making the right decisions that's in America's best interests. And you heard what he said about certain laws that were passed that he didn't like necessarily, but so be it. This is how America became America, not by a president sitting in the Oval Office saying, the hell with Congress, the hell with the Constitution. And the most amazing thing, the most upsetting thing, and I wish Horace had a couple of more minutes, was if you saw the images of the president when he was running for president, holding town hall meetings and criticizing President Bush for violating the Constitution. Well, wait a second. Violating the Constitution? I have never before heard anyone say, we're going to put a monitor in a broadcast studio and hover about and make it clear that you better be broadcasting what we think is relevant and important. Goodness gracious, think what a slippery slope that is, folks. That's an ice storm in a control room of a broadcast station. I mean, you slide right off the edge with that one. It is of critical importance. I can't emphasize this enough. It is of critical importance that broadcasters be able to provide their perspectives, and then, as Horace rightfully pointed out, the censorship that we look at in America, or should look at, is self-censorship. You know, you watch a program and you say, boy, this guy is a yo-yo. I can't deal with him anymore. I can't deal with her. I'm not going to listen to those folks. That's cool. That's the freedom of choice that this form of government that we celebrate in America, the Constitution, the First Amendment, it's about Americans deciding for themselves who they want to listen to, what they want to listen to, so that they can turn the dial. My fear, and I think if Horace was still with us on the program, he would probably echo this, is that if the administration had its way, it would be kind of like the way that the Ford Motor Company sold the Model T Ford. You could get it in any color as long as it was black. You can get all the news you want as long as it coincides with the narrative of this administration. That is not freedom of speech, folks. That is what happens when you have state-run media, state-run news. Pravda and Izvestia in the old Soviet Union are prime examples. This is a dangerous concept. And what disturbs me, I mean really disturbs me, is that this administration would even think of attempting a stunt like that. That's what disturbs me. Yes, they've backed off for now, but how trustworthy is somebody who would be willing to do that to our freedom of speech, our freedom of communication, our freedom of thought, if you will? It is Orwellian. It is truly Orwellian. So that's food for thought. And really and truly, I would recommend that you contact your elected representatives, your senators, your members of the House of Representatives, and the White House, and let them get an earful about how dare you. For those Democrats that think that the president was right, put them on record. Do you really think he was right? Make them accountable. Make them squirm. If it's a Republican, I can't imagine. See, it's not about Democrat or Republican, but lately it seems the Democrats tend to march more lockstep with the administration on the issues. Make those folks squirm. Make them understand what a threat this is to our way of life, to our Constitution, to our freedom of That is a vital, vital, vital freedom. It is number one for a reason. The very First Amendment to the Constitution, the very first item in the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech. You start tampering with that, where are we now? Where do you want to take this country, Mr. President? And that's something that we ought to be demanding an answer to. That is what we need an answer to. When you listen to the nonsense about the unemployment statistics and how many people have enrolled in Obamacare, imagine if the administration could go into a radio station and say, if you disagree with us on those numbers, we're going to lift your license. You know, here's a point that I want to make. I was with Doreen Finkel in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago. We taped a video, and it's out there, for the Tea Party, campus Tea Party. And I did a 30-minute video interview with her. And one of the points that I started out during our interview was to ask her, and I'm going to ask you, how many times have you personally been physically present when a newsworthy event took place? I don't mean you saw it on TV or you heard about it from you. When were you standing there and that night, whatever it was you saw, experienced, whatever, made it to the evening news? It's very rare, unless, you know, you're a law enforcement officer or an astronaut or whatever. Most people can go many, many years without ever witnessing a newsworthy event in person. And when you see news that's coming out of the Ukraine, the demonstrations right now over freedom and democracy, and whether they're going to go east or west, whether they're going to tilt towards Russia or tilt towards Europe, you know, we're depending on journalists to tell us what's going on. We're not there. So we turn on the TV expecting to be educated, to be informed, to get the news of the day that will affect the way we understand the world. Depend almost entirely on journalists. That is part of why freedom of the press is so much a part of our democracy, because the Founding Fathers understood that if reporters couldn't honestly report and openly report whatever it was they saw and experienced, then the electorate, we the people, would have no way of knowing what's happening. If you can turn off the news, you've got a serious problem. You know, when rebels overthrow a government, when there's a coup d'etat, one of the first things the rebels do is they seize the television stations. They seize the radio stations. They control the flow of information so that instead of news, you get propaganda. You cannot have a democracy without free press, without free broadcasting, where people are free to speak their mind. Frank Sinatra sings a wonderful song about what is America to me, and one of the things he talks about is the right to speak your mind out. The right to speak your mind out. And we have an administration that made an attempt, in my view, to curtail that freedom. And it's a very dangerous move. But what's most disturbing isn't just that they attempted it. What disturbs me is I'd like to know why. Why this attempt was made. Something for you to think about. It's very disquieting and it's very significant. This wasn't a minor incident. This was a major incident. And I'd like to know why. What is the end game? How far would this continue if it hadn't been pulled back because there was enough of an outcry? And this is why I always make the point that democracy is not a spectator sport. We can't sit back and say, let someone else do the lifting. I'm too busy watching some program on TV. I'm too busy playing with my Xbox. Yes, it's fine to have recreation. I'm all for recreation. We could lose our minds if we don't have a place to chill out for a bit. But folks, we live in a very perilous world. We are threatened by all sorts of issues that are of extreme significance. We still are living under the threat of terrorism. We are seeing more and more criminal activities, the concerns about the cartels operating in the United States. There have been hearings about Mexican cartel members getting political asylum so they can operate inside our borders. When I was up at DEA Intelligence, I was shocked to find out that in New York, back in the late 80s, early 90s, something like 60% of the people we were arresting up at the DEA Drug Task Force were identified as being foreign-born. So you look at all these threats, you look at the open borders, you look at a guy by the name of de Blasio here in New York, the mayor, who wants to provide illegal aliens with identity documents. And I just wrote an article for CAPS, and I don't know if I had mentioned their terrific website, so let me just spend a couple of minutes talking about CAPS. They're located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. They're terrific people. I've been out there a bunch of times, and the weather gets to be like it's been this winter. Santa Barbara sounds awfully wonderful to me on the Pacific Coast in Southern California. Magnificent place. They're great people. I've been a senior fellow for them for a number of years, where I joined many other writers to provide the perspectives on immigration and other similar issues that, frankly, no one else is really covering. And while the name sounds like, well, it's just a local outfit, Californians for Population Stabilization, you need to understand that the failures of the immigration system in California are among the worst in the country. But as California goes, so goes the rest of the United States. And this is not about being opposed to immigration or immigrants. This isn't about vilifying or scapegoating anybody. As an immigration agent, I didn't only arrest people from Latin America. I mean, the other side tries to make it into something like that, and it's not. The only distinction we made is between citizens and non-citizens, and the proper legal term for a non-citizen is alien, which, by the way, will raise eyebrows among the open borders advocates, the folks I call the immigration anarchists. But they themselves are willing to use the word alien, interestingly enough, when they talk about the DREAM Act, because the A in DREAM Act is alien minors. So I would love for you to go to the CAPS, Californians of Population Stabilization website. It's capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. Pardon me. My own personal website is Michael Cutler, one word, michaelcutler.net. And so I've been doing a lot of writing for them. My most recent article focused on Mayor de Blasio's efforts. I called it Carte Blanche, and they renamed it the New York City Mayor wants to give ID to illegal aliens or a title similar to that. It should be up on their website within the next day or two. And I called my article Carte Blanche, and sometimes they like a title a little differently than I do, and that's fine. You know, when you have an editor, that's what happens, and I certainly have no problem with it. Carte Blanche was a play on carte blanche, which literally means giving people, you know, license to do whatever they want. And that's really what we're experiencing with immigration in New York and elsewhere. And what's so astonishing is because I had worked for the old INS going back to 1971, back in 71, no one would even have thought of giving people who were illegally present in the United States an official identity document. And the federal government would have reacted by prosecuting people for such a thing. I'm going to give you a quick section of law, and I never turned my program into a law lecture. I just had a constitutional law professor on the show, and we didn't cite a single section of law, and I'm proud of that, because I don't want this to become boring, but I want you to know there is a section of law, and it's Title 8, United States Code, Section 1324, and it deals with alien smuggling and harboring and shielding and aiding and abetting and inducing aliens to enter the United States in violation of law, and inducing aliens and enabling them and shielding them and transporting them so that while they're in the United States, they're not detected. That sort of shielding or harboring is a felony. And you've got the mayor of New York City, one of the biggest cities in the country, openly saying, we're going to give you folks identity documents. They're doing it in California. As I said, as goes California, so goes the rest of the country. Now, I want to make a point that's really, really, really important, and I can't stress this enough. The folks with an agenda to eradicate our borders and stop the enforcement of our immigration laws try to use these innocuous-sounding terms so it doesn't sound like a big deal. These folks who are here from other countries are undocumented. Well, what does that sound like? Gee whiz, I don't have my library card. I guess I'm undocumented. Let me tell you what it really means. They were never inspected. They did not come through a port of entry if we're talking about the undocumented. If you have aliens who violated the terms of their visa, as did the terrorists and other criminals and other people who were working illegally and so forth, they're documented, but they violated the terms of their admission. So if we're going to talk about illegal aliens, and everyone gets all upset, oh, no one's illegal. And it's just so funny when you hear that, because I remember the day after Labor Day when they closed down all the beaches in the New York City area. I don't know what they do in California. They probably have their beaches going 24/7 down in Santa Barbara. But here in New York, Labor Day and the party's over, whether it's New York, whether it's New Jersey. And one of the stories on CBS Radio, I was listening to the radio, and they said that the police had found a bunch of people swimming in the ocean, but because it was after Labor Day, there were no lifeguards on duty, and consequently, the beach was closed to the public. They put up these big fences, interesting parallel, they put up the big fences with big signs that says, no trespassing, beach closed. And the program that would never refer to an illegal alien as an illegal alien referred to those swimmers who were swimming in violation of law. You ready for this, folks? Sit down and hang on to your armrest. Here it comes. CBS News reported them to be illegal swimmers. Well, if you can be an illegal swimmer, why in the world can't you be an illegal alien? But what do I know? The lack of what I call mouth-ear coordination really blows my mind sometimes. Because, if you look at the statements that keep being made by our elected representatives, it's truly astonishing. You had Mayor Bloomberg, the predecessor to Mayor de Blasio, the guy that doesn't want salt or sugar or whatever, but doesn't talk about heroin or cocaine, which I find astonishing. But Mayor Bloomberg was really, really, really torqued because he said, you know what? The prosecutors up in the Bronx going after the people who trespass on public housing. It was just astonishing. He actually said that nobody is going after these people. They're trespassing, and that creates a problem, but no one's going after them. They need to be arrested and prosecuted if they trespass, because someone who trespasses is up to no good. Let me read a quote from Mr. Bloomberg, and this was in a newspaper article, or this was on CBS Radio, I guess, August 16th, 2013. This past August, just about 6 months ago, not even. Bloomberg said, this is the quote, The people that live there in public housing, most of them want more police protection. They want more people. If you have strangers walking in the halls of your apartment building, don't you want somebody to stop and say, who are you? Why are you here? Wait a second. Let me read that again, because maybe you missed it. Here's the mayor of New York that openly declared New York to be a sanctuary city, said that people that are trespassing in buildings should be stopped and should be asked, who are you? Why are you here? You know what's remarkable about those two questions? The first 4 years of my career, I served as an immigration inspector assigned to John F. Kennedy International Airport. And when a passenger would arrive in my booth at the airport, that was what we asked them. Why are you here? Who are you? How long do you plan to stay? What's the purpose for your visit? People run the border. They don't get asked that question because they know if they answer the question honestly, they will be denied entry. Perhaps they're coming to work illegally. Perhaps they're coming because they committed a heinous crime in another country and they're on the run. They are a fugitive. Perhaps they were sent here because they're part of a transnational criminal organization and they're supposed to set up shop in some town in America. This isn't just the Mexican problem. Think back to what I just said about New York. In New York City, something like 60% of all the people that we were arresting for drug trafficking were identified as foreign-born. Some came across the Mexican border, and some folks came through Kennedy International Airport or some other airport and set up shop. So when someone evades that process, doesn't get to be asked that question, doesn't have to give an answer to that question, who are you? Why are you here? That's a problem. But yet Mayor Bloomberg could have cared less, but don't do it in public housing. You can trespass on America. We don't care. Just stay out of the public housing projects. This lack of mouth-ear coordination is staggering. Mayor de Blasio said that he wants to protect the immigrants. Well, first of all, we're talking about illegal aliens. And we need to have a little clarity. The difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. So you've got Mayor de Blasio saying, we're going to protect the immigrants, and we're going to give them ID. Who are we protecting them from? If you're giving somebody an identity document because they violated the laws that's supposed to protect America primarily, initially, from terrorists and transnational criminals, why are you protecting them? Why are you harboring and shielding them? It's a felony under the immigration laws if these folks are in fact aliens who are illegally present in the United States. It violates common sense. And who is he protecting and shielding them from? Law enforcement? If some guy is wanted for a bank robbery and you put him up in your house and it could be shown that you knew that the guy was wanted for bank robbery or rape or murder, you go to jail for harboring a fugitive. New York City, wittingly or unwittingly, serves as home to many fugitives from other countries. And by doing so, not only does it violate law, but it creates a problem for public safety. There was an article that was published in the New York Times about 2 years ago in 2012 talking about Roosevelt Avenue in Queens, New York. It was considered the Avenue of Vice. And they were showing how this is the one place in the United States where arguably the most counterfeit identity documents are sold. And they linked it to the drug trade. They linked it to prostitution. They linked those documents to a whole panoply of crimes because it's about hiding in plain sight. So you have members of the New York State Senate. I saw a bunch of articles written by a state senator by the name of Peralta, New York State Senate, really excited about this and saying, we need tougher laws against people who sell phony identity documents. I have no problem with that. And I haven't spoken to Senator Peralta. I'd love to talk to him. But I'd love to know what his position is on the mayor wanting to provide illegal aliens with identity documents. Because here's the fundamental question that no one's asking. And I hate to sound like Hillary, but what difference does it make? What difference does it make if you provide somebody with an identity document and you're a document vendor, you're a guy that cranks these things out on your desktop computer in your garage somewhere, or if you're the city of New York giving people identity documents without being able to verify their identities. The same threat to public safety exists whether it's the city of New York that provides that documents or the guy down the block with a printing press that's providing the documents. Either way, you're providing people with identity documents even though you can't verify who they are. Either way, the threat is the same. Now, I mean, maybe it's that Mayor de Blasio wants to put those document vendors out of business, but instead of arresting them, compete with them and drive them out of business that way. Maybe he wants to have a monopoly on the business. I don't know. I'm just trying to put myself in his mindset because I have to tell you, I can't understand it. For the life of me, I can't understand it. How in the world does it benefit us in New York to have people wandering around with identity documents that act as camouflage? When you think about the process of arresting people, regardless of who's being arrested or why, not just immigration violations, but when you think of the booking process, you know, book them, Dano, what do you immediately think about? Well, you think about the cops or the agents doing a lot of paperwork and doing two things that involve biometrics, taking fingerprints and photographs. And why do we do that? And I've certainly been involved with the arrest of thousands of people who broke the law in my 30-year tenure with immigration. Why do we fingerprint and photograph people? Because we anticipate that when you arrest somebody, they're going to lie about their name. They're going to use a false alias. The term alias conjures up a very negative image, and it should, because what decent, honest person is going to lie about who they are? The only types of people who lie about their true identities are undercover agents and usually criminals. I was on a radio program, a campus show at Hofstra University a long time ago. And in fact, the young man who was hosting the program was a student at the time, is now a producer over at Fox and Friends. And then we have occasional conversations, and it's always great when I am on Fox and Friends, and I try to get a hold of him and so we could have a conversation. But I remember being on his radio show, and some student called up, and he went off on, boy, you're a terrible guy and you don't want to help all these people out. So I gave him a hypothetical situation, because the hypotheticals, folks, really do it for most people. And I said to this guy who called in, supposing you went to a frat party and you met the girl of your dreams. Her face is like nothing you've ever seen before. Great body, very athletic, great sense of humor, wonderful personality, very bright, everything you're interested in, she's interested in. You can't believe you are so lucky that you met what would seem to be your soulmate. And let's say for 6 months you're dating this young lady and you travel with her and weekends are heaven and you can't wait to get to Friday because then you have another weekend with her. And then one day over dinner she says to you, you know, for the last 6 months, I told you my name was Barbara, but in reality, my name is Janet, or whatever. Pick whatever names you want. I said, how would you feel about that person? And the guy thought about it. He was very honest. He says, you know, that would really scare the hell out of me. I said, why? He says, well, if someone's going to lie about who they are, how much can you trust them on any other issue? And that's the point here, folks. That's the point here. Why in the world would the city of New York, the city that was hammered the hardest on 9/11, willingly provide identity documents to people who may well have very good reasons for concealing their true identities, beyond the fact that they ran the border to get a job? And, you know, we all want to feel sympathetic toward people who are downtrodden and people who are suffering and people who are poor. No two ways about it. We do. And I can't tell you how many times if I arrested an illegal alien who looked undernourished, even though they would feed them over at a detention facility, I'd stop by a nice kosher deli, what else do you expect from a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, and buy them a sandwich out of my own pocket, not because I'm anybody special, it's because we're compassionate. We tend to be. That's one of the great strengths of America and Americans, is our compassion, which is why it's so infuriating when political asylum is used by people like the Tsarnaev brothers and other terrorists in the past. A guy by the name of Kansi who shot up the CIA, and Ramzi Youssef, who participated in the first Trade Center attack. These guys who got political asylum and then killed Americans. Very upsetting. But the idea that we don't know who people are and yet we're going to give them identity documents and perhaps facilitate the ability of some really evil people to hide themselves in plain sight. See, the problem is we don't know what we don't know. And what Mayor de Blasio needs to understand, needs to remember, was that as the mayor of New York, number one, he's the top cop, even though he's not the police commissioner. He's the executive that runs the whole government, including the law enforcement mission. And he took an oath to the Constitution and to the laws of the city of New York. And he also has the moral responsibility to look out for the safety and well-being of all the people who live in New York, whether we're talking about members of the immigrant community or United States citizens. And what's so amazing to me, and you go back to that New York Times article, and I really urge you to go to the CAPS website. They're going to have that article up that I just wrote. And you look at that article in the New York Times going back to 2012, and you look at these women who were coerced into becoming prostitutes and all kinds of degradation and exploitation and crimes of violence that play out. And it's not just within the Latino community. You see it in all the ethnic communities. Now, how do I know? Because as an immigration agent, I've arrested aliens from just about every continent, every country perhaps, or close to every country on this planet. It's not about people of a particular skin color, religion, or ethnicity. It's about people who come here from other countries because they're on the run, because they pose a threat. It's because they're violating the laws that are designed to shield Americans, first of all, in terms of public safety, from criminals, from terrorists, from people with dangerous communicable diseases. Think of all these diseases that we thought we had eradicated that are now rearing their ugly heads again. Whether they're reported in the news is another story, but I can assure you that when you read about stuff like dengue fever and other such terrible illnesses, it may well be because somebody came into this country without having been inspected, never had a physical exam, so they were harboring that disease. You know, Ellis Island was a quarantine station. And so if you look at all these issues, please understand that those laws exist to protect innocent lives and the jobs of American workers. And when a politician can stand there and say, oh, the immigration laws, ha, who cares? Well, what they're really saying is they don't really care about public safety. What they're really saying is we don't care if we displace American workers with foreign workers. We have record numbers of unemployed Americans. And every time you hear someone stand up and talk about the jobs Americans won't do, you ought to look that guy in the eye and tell him what you think of him. My dad will always be my biggest hero. He was a construction worker. He was a plumber. I grew up on construction sites. My pop helped to build the World's Fair. And I got to tell you what a joy it was to go with him on weekends and hang out at the World's Fair. I got to ride on that Swiss Sky Ride that they had put up before it was open to the public. As soon as the building inspectors said it was safe, I got on that thing and we went clear across the park on that Swiss Sky Ride. It was fun. My dad worked at John F. Kennedy Airport on the hangars. Unfortunately, that hangar has since been torn down, and it feels like they tore down a little piece of my background, my past, because my dad worked on that hangar for the TWA planes, rather. The 707s used to be parked in those hangars, and I remember that. So I grew up on construction sites, and you go to construction sites today, and you look at hardworking Americans of every ethnicity, every race, doesn't matter. They're out there in the freezing winter. They're out there in the sweltering summer. And those construction workers work their tails off, and that work is more dangerous than law enforcement. And they're out there every day earning that paycheck. And when you hear people that can look down their nose at hardworking blue-collar Americans, they're not the friends of this country. They have an agenda. We are undermining America's workers and the families of American workers. And it's not just the blue-collar trades. It's also about the high-tech visas, the H-1Bs. Comprehensive reform, folks, would have taken that number from 65,000 where it is now, potentially up to close to 200,000 with an intermediate stop of about 115,000, but with provisions where they could increase it even more. Ted Cruz, by the way, this very conservative senator from Texas, who's being mentioned as a potential presidential candidate, testified before a Senate hearing where he proposed what he called Amendment Cruz 5 for comprehensive reform. And incredibly, he wants to increase the number of H-1B visas by 500%, bringing them up to 325,000. And meanwhile, if you look at the unemployment statistics, college kids in America who graduate with degrees in high-tech fields are suffering from a 14.7% unemployment rate. Now, I think that's a low ball number, but these are the labor statistics from the Labor Department that claims that there's a 6.6% overall unemployment rate. So when those statistics that could be as low as 6.6% for all workers talks about a 14.7% unemployment rate for American kids who graduated with STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math degrees, I want to know how any politician could look anybody in the eye and say to them, oh, we have a shortage of those workers. We need to staple green cards onto the diplomas of foreign students. You know, we have a choice in America. We can either put American kids and American students and American workers first, or we can ignore the plight of the American worker. We can ignore the fact that one in four American kids, according to so many different studies, now lives below the poverty line. When you have kids living in abject poverty, where they know that they could never, ever possibly afford a college education, where they know that without an education they'll be lucky if they make a couple of bucks more than minimum wage, they also know that they will never get out of living in those rat-infested buildings on a minimum wage job. If you keep running through a maze and every time you make a turn you come to a dead end, how soon will it be before you make some really bad decisions to find a way to get enough money to get out of a building that you share with rats and all sorts of vermin? Some kids live in a pretty desperate place these days. This isn't conjecture. I didn't do a study. I just spent 26 years on the streets of some of New York City's toughest neighborhoods, and I encountered it all the time. I encountered the filth and the squalor. One of my buddies retired. I went to his retirement dinner. I'd worked with this guy for well over a quarter of a century, and he said to me, you know, Mike, I'm going to miss working with you and the other guys here and the gals. But he said, I'm going to tell you the one thing I won't miss, and that's the stench of poverty. We are stymieing efforts of American kids to get ahead, and then you have Governor Cuomo of New York saying that maybe we should have college classes in the prisons so that when kids get out of jail after they've been arrested, maybe they'll have a brighter future. I have a better idea. Why aren't we subsidizing the education of children who live in poverty now so that they never wind up in a prison, so that they never hurt somebody, but have opportunities, they have outlets for their talents and their drive and their desire to excel? We have a reverse xenophobia in America today where we're told that Americans are either too lazy to do the backbreaking, filthy, dangerous jobs like my dad did, or too stupid to do the high-tech jobs. Now, on the issue of stupid, there might be something there, because we keep electing the same clowns year in and year out. The power of the incumbency is incredible. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some incumbents who are really excellent. I could give you my short list of and it's not all-inclusive, so I'm leery about doing this. But I'll tell you, if there's one guy I would love to see sitting in the Oval Office come the next election, it would give me my first opportunity for an honest-to-God's night's sleep for the first time since 9/11, and that would be Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama. And if you look at Congressman Lou Barletta, and you look at Congressman Steve King, Trey Gowdy seems to be trying to do the right thing. There's some good people. But I've got to tell you, there's some others. Chuck Grassley, good job in the Senate. But understand the problem that we have. Senator Vitter, another good guy. But they're few and far between. When you have an elected representative who's willing to besmirch their fellow Americans and belittle Americans who work their rear ends off to make this country, that congressman needs to find out what the unemployment line looks like. That representative isn't representing you, and he's not representing me, and he's not representing American families. There's been over $1.5 billion spent on pushing for comprehensive immigration reform by the likes of Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and all the other characters and Bloomberg and all these other folks that all they see are dollar signs. How can we drive down the wages of American workers so we can increase our profits? You know, when somebody steals a loaf of bread because he or she is hungry or maybe has a hungry child at home, you can understand why they did what they did. If I was a cop and saw it happen, I'd probably wind up paying for the loaf of bread and letting them get a dozen eggs and some milk while they're on the way out and pick up the whole tab and certainly not want to arrest them for it. But when you have people that are worth billions of dollars, they fly around the world in their own jet airliner, and they own, you know, a dozen mansions somewhere, and then they think they still need more money? Let me tell you, there's no place, there's a place in hell for somebody like that. I'm all about making a profit. I'm all about being successful. But to tear down this country so that you can increase your profits and turn the American dream on its ear and talk glowingly about illegal aliens having their share of the American dream while ignoring the plight of American citizens in their own country, that's not acceptable. I believe it's American Express that has a wonderful slogan. They say that membership has its rewards. I think it's time that citizenship in the United States should have its rewards as well. It's vital that we get that message out there, folks. The biggest problem that we face in America today is apathy of too many Americans and the problems that go with it. And the only solution that I can recommend to you is that we've got to get our voices heard. And if you think that you're just one person, and how in the world could you possibly make a difference, I want you to think about all the history books you've ever read. Think back to the American Revolution. How many people participated in that Revolutionary War? But there's only a relative handful of names that come to mind. Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, John Quincy Adams. You understand the point. It's always the few people that make all the difference in the world. No different today. No different today. We all have a voice that needs to be heard. This is why I always like to make that point that democracy is not a spectator sport. We really have to get our voice heard, folks. There's no excuse for sitting home and ignoring the situation and hoping it will get better. Hope is certainly not a strategy. Again, I'm going to give you two websites. Your homework assignment, I hope you accept it, is to please visit michaelcutler.net. Please go to capsweb.org. Check out my articles. Check out the other great articles that the other contributors write for them. I think you will find it interesting and eye-opening. They've been hammering away at the damage being done to American workers and America's minorities because of the failures of our government to enforce the immigration laws and secure America's borders against unlawful entry. It's not about shutting down the borders. It's not about doing anything crazy like that. It's simply about having our government live up to its obligations of taking those prudent steps necessary to protect innocent lives and the jobs of American workers. You know, our borders and our immigration laws are our first line of defense. They're also our last line of defense. And it's time that we, the people, made those people that we elected to represent us truly represent us. So please go to michaelcutler.net. Please go to capsweb.org. I'm looking forward to my visit out with the Tea Party groups in New Jersey this coming Tuesday. Can't wait to get there. It's going to be a fun evening. And for all of you out there, if you become aware of any opportunities where I could perhaps do a speaking event, provide perspectives. I love doing question and answer periods because that's really where the rubber meets the road, where we can have a conversation. And if you have burning questions that you want answered, great opportunity to do it. I've been doing this all over the country ever since 9/11. I'd love to come out to your neck of the woods. You can reach me through michaelcutler.net, or you can contact me through capsweb.org, and we'll see if we can't make that happen. Meanwhile, I hope that you all have a terrific weekend. Look forward to seeing you again at the same time, same place next week. By the way, tomorrow I will be doing two radio programs. Hopefully you're on my email list. It should be up on my website also, but I got two radio shows to do tomorrow where I'll be guesting on other folks' programs. It's all part of this mission that I've been on ever since 9/11 to provide the experiences and perspectives that I acquired during my 30-year career with the former Immigration and Naturalization Service. We will see you next week, folks. And meanwhile, again, please remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Have a great weekend, everybody. See you next week.